We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. We ended our week-long Project Milwaukee State of Upheaval on Friday morning with a seven-member panel discussion, moderated by Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. It was broadcast live in front of a studio audience at Cudahy's Irish Pub at the Pabst Theater. After the show ended at 11, members of the audience posed questions to our panel, which we recorded for air today. Our guests were Milwaukee County Department of Aging Director Stephanie Sue Stein, Assemblyman Robin Voss, Assemblywoman Jocasta Zamaripa, Teacher Hedy Eyscheid, County Supervisor Joe Sanfilippo, GenMet President Mary Eisbister, and Common Council Member Mullaly Coggs. Mitch Tyke fielded questions from the audience, and we begin with the first participant.
Hi, I'm Dave Vandiver. I'm from Franklin. My question is for the business owners, for Mary, Joe, and Robin. In your businesses, do you provide health insurance for your employees and retirement plans?
All your employees.
At GenMet, we offer health insurance. As a company, we pay 60%, actually about 63%, and our employees pay 40%. We've been lucky enough that our business has been successful enough over the last 5 years to, even though we've taken increases in health insurance costs, we have kept what we charge the employees the same, so they have not seen an increase in the last 5 years in their health insurance cost. But that's because we have a successful business. You can only do that when your business is doing well. As far as retirement plans, we have a 401k plan that's safe harbored, which means we have the maximum match, which we match immediately. People are 100% vested immediately. They can take that money with them if they choose to leave our organization. Hopefully they don't. But generally, we see the benefits we offer our employees as two things. Number one, a sign of the success of the business as a result of their contribution. As you know, our business has all to do with, it's only successful if our employees make it successful. So if it's successful, it's based on their contribution. And second of all, it's how we compete. We are not a unionized environment, but we believe that by offering the absolute best possible benefits to our employees is how we are going to attract and retain the best employees.
Before we go on to get your response, Joe, and your response, Robin, I think there are some that would ask the question, should the state compete in that very same way? Should the state seek to get the best workers it can by offering those very same kinds of incentives?
I was going to say, from my understanding, the state has pretty darn good benefits.
Well, right, but I think that's what was at the crux of a lot of the debate of the last year was whether the employees should be in a position where they're paying more.
I think the difference is, if it got to the point where the health insurance costs increased beyond what the company could absorb, we would ask the employees would have to contribute more. So we have that option. I'm not sure the way the state is set up, there's an option to share that with the employees.
Robin Voss or Joe Sanfilippo, either one of you.
Yeah, my company, if you're full-time, you have access to health insurance. If you're part-time, you do not. If with the retirement system, if you are part-time or full-time, we provide 100% match. Up to 6% of your salary. So we do that right now. As far as what state employees pay, though, and I think that's part of the difference of where many times we forget. My assistant, when she began right out of college, the benefits that she got as an employee of the state were immediately upon her first day, she could have 3 weeks of vacation. She got 10 paid holidays. I mean, she got all kinds of things where she actually came to me and said, wow, I can't believe how good these benefits are for a brand new employee. You don't have any vesting requirement. You don't have any kind of requirement to even work a month before you can take your vacation. I mean, none of those things happened. So I think that's part of the disconnect between the employees that I have, where, yes, we have paid holidays. We have all of those things. But they certainly don't get access to all of their vacation on the first day that they start. I think that they certainly don't get free health insurance where many local governments had. They certainly don't get a contribution for their retirement where they have no match whatsoever. So I think that's the disconnect that I think many people in the private sector and the public sector see, that the public sector has benefits that, yes, were negotiated over time, but the difficulty is, and I can say as a former county board supervisor, when you looked at those contracts, you looked at the new benefits. So the fact that somebody had given away free health insurance or free life insurance or unlimited whatever was all negotiated before, and in order to get rid of those, you had to give them an even richer benefit. Well, that's how we got into the world that we're in, and it's why we needed to make dramatic changes, and that's the only way we can move forward.
I suspect there's a public employee or two who will want to jump in with a follow-up question. But Joe Sanfilippo, let me get back to the question the gentleman here just asked.
Yeah, I sold my business in 2005. But when I was running my business, I did have a 401k plan. At some points during the time, I had some employees that were union employees. They had a pension through the union. We did have health insurance. I started out for about the first 8 or 9 years of my business, I paid 100% of the health insurance for my employees, even though it was a seasonal business. So they were earning money for me only 9 months out of the year off in the summer months, but I paid it. But as those costs increased, I was forced to institute a co-payment plan with employees. And by the time it got to at the point when I had sold my business, we were at a 50-50 share. The company paid 50%, the employee paid 50%. But one thing to keep in mind, is, as Robin mentioned, is you can't just look at something and say, you know, do you provide insurance or versus the public sector or the private sector, but you look at what those benefits are. When I ran my own business, I paid $1,600 a month for health insurance for my family. That was with a $5,000 deductible. Now, this goes back to 2005. At the county, I can tell you right now, I pay $170 a month for health insurance. That is 100 times better than what I could afford in the private sector. So asking me as a public employee, because I'm paying more for my share of the health care now, to kick in a little bit more, yes. The difference being, I've been in a position where I've signed not only the back of a paycheck, but I've signed the front of the paycheck. And I know what those benefits cost. And so you have to rein them in. And you can't continue to provide something that you can't afford. When you do that in the private sector, you go broke, out of business. When you do it in the public sector, you just continually to raise taxes or increase your debt. And that's the difference. And we now are saying the public sector has to start acting more like the private sector and bring those costs in line.
I have a follow-up question, but I suspect Hedy Eyscheid is going to make this point for me.
Maybe. My comment is I get concerned when I hear us talk about health care, because I think health care is a complex, much larger issue than we have time for discussion here in the sound bites that we have. But I think that we should be talking about bringing everybody up to the highest common denominator of care and not pulling everybody down to the lowest common denominator. And that's what I have seen played out in the last several months is you have it and I don't, so you shouldn't. And I think that's not the right conversation to be having. I think the conversation to be having is how can we all have the best benefit that allows us all to take care of our families and our children.
Jocasta Zamarripa, you had something to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to remind everybody that this really isn't about concessions. The truth is that way back in February, the days of the orange T-shirts and the 60-plus hours of debate on the floor, the teachers, nurses, public workers had agreed to concessions. And I know that. My colleague, Representative Voss, knows that. Governor Walker knows that. Concessions were agreed to by our public workers. But the governor felt the need to move forward and strip their rights as workers, collective bargaining rights. That is the fight, not the concessions. They did concede. We do know that there has to be shared sacrifice. The collective bargaining rights were being repealed. Workers' rights, the right to bargain for working conditions. That is what the fight is about, and that is why we saw thousands upon thousands of people convene onto the state capitol earlier this year.
Stephanie Sue Stein, you had something you wanted to add, and I think Robin Voss, you looked like you wanted to jump in as well.
I just want to say that this isn't just public employees anymore. The two largest companies in this state with people on Medicaid are Walmart and Aurora Healthcare. So your business is paying for health care for people who work at one of the most profitable corporations in the world, because they do not let part-time employees anymore have access to health care, and the health care that they used to have them have access to, they couldn't have afforded to buy. So you are not just paying for public employees, who, by the way, are also paying substantial taxes to pay for each other's health care. So it's not just you. And it isn't just the public sector. What did we say to Evinrude? What did we say to the people at Harley-Davidson? Give up your benefits, give up your wage increases, or we will move out of this state. We want you to be just as poor as everyone else. So that it's We are moving in the absolute wrong direction for all workers. We talk about jobs as if they are the holy grail, but we denigrate workers in every way we can.
Robin Voss?
Well, first of all, the discussion, if you recall, the unions for the state were negotiating with the Doyle administration and left the bargaining table in September because the state of Wisconsin was going to ask them to pay $4 more a month for their health insurance. Remember, they left the bargaining table over that. Then they came back and they tried to ram through contracts in December in a lame duck legislature when the Democrats were still in control, and even the Democratic majority leader said that was wrong, which is why, after trying to ram through those contracts, then they came and said, well, leave all of our collective bargaining rights exactly like they always have been, and trust us, we'll give you those benefits. Trust us. We won't go back on our word. Well, we had seen the ramifications of the way they dealt with us before. So this idea of somehow saying that they could speak for everyone statewide when you have locals in every single county, city, village, school district. And as Joe mentioned before, when the opportunity was given, because don't forget, in the budget that we passed, we put a proposal in there that says anyone who had a collective bargaining contract in place could voluntarily give back their pension and their health care as a way to help deal with the deficit in their school district and still keep their collective bargaining. Do you want to ask me how many of those districts just voluntarily said we'll give back the pension and their health care like they promised us in February? Well, the answer is zero, because it is a hollow promise that was not true, that was only done for political purposes, not to actually solve the deficit.
It's interesting listening to people who've been at the state and who are a member of a party debate these issues. But I just can't help but to think, as you know, I sat with constituents and take calls every day for them dealing with the impact of the decisions that are being made in Madison, how much and so many times they say, well, why did this happen? Why the voter ID bill? Where was the fraud? And I say, they can't prove any. And they say, why the cuts to the unions? And just all of this stuff, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think that people aren't quite forthright with the whole discussion and dialogue. We make it about all these finite points. Did they agree? Should they have agreed? Is it really about this? Is it really about that? And the honest truth is, if unions in the state of Wisconsin overwhelmingly financially and in other ways supported Republican candidates for federal and state level offices, we would not be having the budget repair bill we had. We would not be having the end to collective bargaining. All the other financial issues could still be true. But the reality is, it's a political game being played, and Wisconsin is at the center of it. Much of the legislation beyond the budget repair bill, beyond all of that, makes absolutely no sense. And we all know it. And it's all about political posturing, who wants to support who, and who is going to win this state for the presidency, and who is going to remain in the governor's office, and who is going to control policy as we move forward. And I think that people are disingenuous when they don't admit that reality.
In the interests of hearing from some more people in our studio audience, let me just jump to the next question. Sir, if you would introduce yourself and tell us where you're from.
Yes, my name is Albert Brown. I'm from Milwaukee. And I was curious to change things along the public transit. That is something I depend on. I like public transit. Just recently, within the past 12 months, there was an offer by the federal government to be able to offer high-speed rail, to be able to cross throughout the whole sector from Chicago to Milwaukee. And that was just voted down. And I'm just asking, why would that, with jobs and all these different things that would come with it, the infrastructure, businesses could spring up along the way, what happened? Why was this voted down?
And let me help frame the question a little bit more, and I'm curious to get both Mary Eisbister and Robin Voss to weigh in on this. But Mary Eisbister, you know, you talk about the kinds of things that make it favorable to create jobs. How important is that kind of that part of the equation, the workers getting to their job at your facility, and what should the state do knowing that someone's got to pay for it?
I've always been a huge proponent of public transit. I'm originally from the East Coast, and a lot of the large cities on the East Coast and West Coast have extremely well-developed public transit systems, whether they be the bus systems or the subway systems or light rail or trolley cars, actually. And I think having a very well-developed public transit system is very important to business. It is a key factor that drives the ability to get employees. Frankly, I'd probably give my right arm, maybe the left arm, to have a public transit system that would take people from Milwaukee and bring them to Mequon. It's one of the biggest issues we have is transportation up to our facility. So I don't know why necessarily, I think it's a complex issue why light rail was not moved forward. But personally, and as a business owner, I think infrastructure is important. I think having access to good highways and the access of individuals to get to a place of employment through a public transit system is extremely important, and I'm very supportive of that.
Robin Voss, why does it always seem that the people who are generally seen as the ones most looking out for the interests of business as an economic driver aren't necessarily the ones who are the strongest advocates for things like mass transit?
Sure, and I can tell you I was one of the leading opponents of the car speed rail, so I have no problem with that. If you look at the proposal that was actually brought forward, it would have taken people from downtown Milwaukee to a place, well, there was different locations, but near the airport in Madison. So I'm somebody who goes to Madison almost every single day. So you would look at somebody like me and say, well, I would be a normal commuter on that system, and it would have taken me almost twice as long to take that train as it would have actually done to drive the exact same route. So it's one of those examples. I have always supported the Hiawatha, which is the Amtrak line between Milwaukee and Chicago. I didn't support the crony capitalism and the no-bid contract that Governor Doyle awarded those two trains. That's an example of something that was done wrongly, but I've always supported the Hiawatha. So I think that when you look at it and you say we have to make investments that actually make sense, many times these are done not because there's any economic reasons, but because of crony capitalism and the political idea behind it, not because there's an actual economic demand. The business community did not support the rail system between Madison and Milwaukee. Some individual business leaders in the city of Madison thought it would be good for their economy, but there was actually a study done by the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis talking about the impact of mass transit, mostly trains, not buses, but mostly trains, and whether or not it actually has an economic impact on the community. You know what they found? Almost zero. The only impact that actually ever worked was free subsidies through a TID district or through a TIF district that actually got businesses to locate around that station. It wasn't the commuters. It wasn't the businesses that sprang up. It was other government incentives that got them to move there. So if our entire economy is modeled after buying basically businesses to move into a community, that's not sustainable. So we need to focus on what actually works, which is why a train line like Amtrak from densely populated areas does work. It's why if we would have allowed for the referendum that we had requested, we could have had the creation of the Regional Transit Authority, but instead they said we know better and we're just going to impose a new tax on people, which is something that we weren't going to do. So I think there are potential answers, but many times they're difficult and they're going to require more citizen input than just a couple people in a closed door raising taxes to fund public transit.
Joe Sanfilippo, did you have something to add?
Yeah, I think it goes back to a couple of things. And prioritizing our spending is number one. But to preface that, specifically with the rail line that you're talking, I mean, if somebody wants to come and give me one of them nice fancy houses on Lake Drive, that's great. I'd love it. But then I'm going to be stuck with having to pay for that house. Well, I can't afford to pay for it, so what good does giving me that house do? We have the same situation with that train. We could have gotten the $800 million from the federal government to build the line and hope that we actually did get it, because in California, I guess the federal government's already reneging on some of the money they said they were going to give them. But after that line is built, the $800 million is spent. We people here in Wisconsin, us taxpayers, we have to pay to operate that line. So now you come to Milwaukee County specifically, an area that I represent. We're struggling to keep our bus system going here in Milwaukee County. We're literally shutting our bus system down one route at a time because we can't afford to run it. So how can I, as a legislator in Milwaukee County, let alone a taxpayer, say, okay, let's take on yet another form of mass transportation we're going to have to pay for when we can't even run the one that we're running right now? And to me, what's more important, a transportation system that'll maybe take people from where they live here in Milwaukee out to where the jobs are, like where Mary's plant is, or do I want to get people on a high-speed rail to get them faster back and forth? I mean, to me, are the primary focus of what we should be doing is the bus system here in Milwaukee County and in other areas about around the state. I mean, not just Milwaukee County. You do need mass transit. But there's a lot more effective ways to spend our money than doing it on rail.
Hedy Eichheide has a response, and I think Stephanie Sue Stein, and then I do want to jump to one more question here before we run out of time for this.
And mine isn't related to rail. I wanted to get in on the last question, and so I hope that's all right, because I wanted to address something that Mr. Voss said as it related to school districts and their employees and taking the benefits, and that zeroed it, and that is simply an inaccurate statement. That, in fact, yes, school districts across the state, teachers and bargaining units, did voluntarily give those benefits. I felt that was an absolutely critical thing to make certain was said.
Stephanie Sue Stein, did you have something to address the transit issue?
Whenever I hear how poor we are and how we can't afford things like mass transit and rail, I think of places like Chicago and Minneapolis who have figured out how to afford those things and have thriving communities. So some people learn how to figure out how to get people from home to jobs and shopping and other places.
Mitch, I just wanted to mention that there's really a very simple reason why we didn't go ahead with high-speed rail, and that is because the Governor Walker wanted to use it as a talking point. He wanted to differentiate himself from Governor Doyle, from Mayor Barrett, who was his opponent, and God forbid we take anything from President Obama. This is a Republican talking point. This is a talking point for Governor Walker to further his own political career to the detriment of Wisconsinites.
In fairness, Governor Walker is not here to defend himself on that point, so let me jump to the next question. If you could introduce yourself, sir.
Stephen Johnson Shelbourne. I'm a Milwaukee resident. I want to respond to something Representative Voss and Supervisor Sanfilippo said. Supervisor Sanfilippo made a comment that 50% of people are not paying taxes and the other half are supporting them, and Representative Voss kind of signed on to that. I'm a little confused. I'm very confused. I don't know who these 50% of people who are not paying taxes are. I'm unemployed. I pay taxes. People may not pay income tax, but they certainly are paying county taxes, state taxes, fees that are charged for various events or programs or anything. They certainly pay sales tax, which is one of the more regressive taxes that there is. So, you know, when you talk about wanting to bring people together, stop using language that pits one group of citizens against another. When you say 50% are supporting the other half, imagine how that makes people who are in the lower rungs of the income scale feel. They see more of a us against them type scenario that you're setting up. I expect to pay income tax. I'm unemployed. I receive an unemployment check. I expect to have to pay income tax. It galls me that here I am. I don't have a job. I'm looking for a job. I have to pay income tax on my meager income. But corporations who are people Exxon, General Electric, do not pay a penny in income tax because of all the deals, the credits, etc. I don't have that opportunity, but they do. I don't see that as fair and right and moral.
Joe Sanfilippo, are we perhaps oversimplifying things, or are we expecting too much to be in a situation where, I mean, won't we always be in a place where some people will need more support and some people will need less support?
Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with that support. And people don't mind paying taxes. I mean, I knock on doors all the time, especially now because we have an election cycle coming up, so I've been doing it a little bit more. Nobody minds paying taxes. And as the gentleman said, we all expect to pay taxes. But when the problem comes in is when people take a look at waste and fraud and abuse in the system that allows our tax dollars to be squandered, that's when the problem comes in. And it doesn't matter how it's wasted, on what type of a program, whether the government's buying military things we really don't need and paying 10 times more for them, or whether, you know, we see fraud in the daycare cases that we've seen throughout the summer. Waste is waste. And so you have to expect to pay taxes. again, it's my opinion, nobody minds paying taxes, but you just want to have value for your money. It's like going to a restaurant. You don't mind paying $5 for a hamburger in a restaurant if you enjoy it. But if you pay $5 for that hamburger and it's worse than one you are going to pay 69 cents for at McDonald's, you're not happy. And that's the same thing with our tax dollars.
And Robin Voss, what about the idea that while there are some in society who are not paying as much as others, there are also some at the far other end of the spectrum, the corporations who are paying less than some other businesses even?
Sure, and that's one area I actually agree with Mr. Johnson. I think that we should not have a system where people can use a lobbyist to get special tax breaks. And unfortunately, in Washington, D.C., that is a problem that infects both parties. It's not a Republican problem or a Democratic problem. It's the fact that corporations get special tax breaks. If it were up to me, we would have one flat tax where everybody pays the exact same, so it's very fair. Everybody pays 10% or 20%, whatever the number is. One thing that I did want to correct, though, when you talked about the half and the half, a lot of people in society get access to something called the Earned Income Tax Credit. And what that usually means is you pay zero income taxes and you get a check from the government that looks like a refund, which people think is an income tax refund, but in fact it's just free money that you never paid in the first place. So there are a huge number of people in our society that get that Earned Income Tax Credit where, once again, they paid in no income taxes and they get a rebate that basically covers the cost of the sales tax, the other taxes that they pay as part of society. So there is an understanding that not everybody does pay. There are a sizable number who get back definitely more than they pay in income taxes, and even in many ways more than they pay in total taxes.
As much as I hate to utter the following words, that is all the time we are going to have for this. Thank you so much to Stephanie Sue Stein, Robin Voss, Hedy Eyeshide, Joe Casta-Zamarripa, Joe Sanfilippo, Mary Eisbister and Malele Coggs, and to everyone in our studio audience here, have a great holiday season.
Lake Effect's Mitch Teich moderated the Project Milwaukee State of Upheaval Q&A session with our studio audience. We recorded it after Friday's Lake Effect program, which was broadcast live from Cudahy's Irish Pub at the Pabst Theater. And that is all the time we have for Lake Effect Weekend. All of our Project Milwaukee State of Upheaval segments are available at wuwm.com/Project Milwaukee. So if you missed anything or just want to listen again, check it out there. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 in the afternoon. And of course, our weekday version of the show comes to you at 10 in the morning. And it's all on WUWM FM and HD1 Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for listening. Stay right here for Weekend All Things Considered, coming up next.